Welcome to Sentient Developments Radio, transhumanist and techno-progressive perspectives on science, philosophy, ethics, and the future of intelligent life. My name is George Dvorsky, and you're listening to the audiocast of my blog, Sentient Developments. Topics discussed on this program include human enhancement, bioethics and emerging technologies, cosmology, metaphysics, spirituality, gender issues, animal welfare, and much, much more. So sit back, relax, and open your mind to Sentient Developments Radio. Hello, and welcome once again to Sentient Developments Radio. I'm George Dvorsky, and I'm podcasting to you today on Wednesday, March the 7th, 2007. I've got three topics lined up today. I'm going to talk about Second Life and its recent issues with in-world terrorism and the struggle for digital rights. Specifically, I'm going to be talking about the Second Life Liberation Army. After that, I'll be describing our Newgenic Nation, and that's going to be a discussion of Newgenics, Dysgenics, and Eugenics. I'm going to provide somewhat of an analysis to see if there is, in fact, such a thing as Newgenics in effect. We'll also see if I'm going to be able to make it through this podcast saying Newgenics. Finally, along the lines of the Eugenics stream, I'm going to be talking about China and how they're moving from the third world to a brave new world and wondering if their eugenic policies are perhaps misguided. I'm going to compare and contrast that with some transhumanist ideas. So, without further ado, let's get started. Life, the immensely popular three-dimensional virtual world, is really starting to take on a life of its own. There are things going on in there that have undoubtedly gone beyond even the wildest expectations of its developers. The latest issue that's caught my attention is the phenomenon of in-world terrorism and the rise of self-professed freedom fighters. Now, these folks, they're not your run-of-the-mill hackers or griefers looking to cause mischief. Rather, these are activists who are working subversively within Second Life to achieve political ends. Their goal is to extend digital rights for Second Life users beyond the standard customer-company relationship. Subsequently, by dealing with current in-world problems, they are, albeit unintentionally, maybe unintentionally, looking ahead to the day when Second Life and other virtual worlds play a much more meaningful role in our lives. Specifically, I am referring to the Second Life Liberation Army, or the SLLA. Their intention is to liberate Second Life users from the perceived tyranny of Linden Labs being the developer of Second Life. The group was formed as the in-world paramilitary wing of a national liberation movement. They argue that universal suffrage is a right that should be established within Second Life immediately. The SLLA, who is led by political officer Marshall Cahill, he contends that Linden Labs has gone beyond its mandate and is now functioning as a de facto authoritarian government. Consequently, they see in-world fighting as the quote-unquote only appropriate response. Annoyed by the steady encroachment of corporations like Reebok and IBM, and if you've ventured into Second Life, you'll know that these companies and other corporations certainly have a presence in there. The SLLA, they work to undermine their virtual presence through disruption, what has been dubbed in-world terrorism. They set off things like atomic bombs, and they fire guns at other users, and they sometimes film these shenanigans and often post them onto YouTube. Now, obviously, no one really gets hurt. The intention here is to create annoyances that will make the gaming experience uncomfortable and bring attention to their struggle. It's just, they're basically creating a nuisance. They say they will not seek to harm the normal operation of the world and will only attack agents of the state and other strategically important sites within Second Life. There's an SLLA website and a blog, and they've listed their demands. So, for example, here's an excerpt from their website. The establishment of basic rights for Second Life players. Having consulted widely, we now believe the best vehicle for this is for Linden Labs to offer public shares in the company. We propose that each player is able to buy one share for a set price. This would serve both the development of the world and provide the beginnings of representation for avatars in Second Life. Again, that's the demand from the SLLAS read off their website. Now, a growing concern among users, admittedly, in Second Life is land scarcity. Second Life has experienced such rapid growth that Linden Labs has been unable to keep up with the demand, which has in turn created land scarcity. Corporations, say the SLLA, are scooping up land and putting up eyesores. Cahill describes himself as a kind of John Adams, a revolutionary who's just trying to make the world a better place. It's an interesting analogy. Many New World settlers who emigrated from Europe were certain they could establish radically new social orders in the Americas. Early settler John Winthrop was famous for saying, "We shall be as a city upon the hill. The eyes of all people are upon us." The goal was to create a new Zion, free from European conventions and political baggage. Today, Second Life and other virtual reality environments reveal the very real possibility that virtual space is livable space. And like the New World, it is virgin territory, unspoilt and open-ended, with all due respect to Native Americans. The prospect for social renewal has some political ideologues, including some transhumanists, frothing at the mouth in consideration of the possibilities. This is terra incognita, and in their mind, utopia is only a few mouse clicks away. At least until the big nasty corporations come in and rain on the parade. And that is precisely why the SLLA has taken it upon themselves to uproot what they perceive to be a very serious problem. Linden Labs claims that by allowing corporations to operate in Second Life, they have opened a legitimate revenue stream. It's only recently, they say, that they have become a profitable company. Which brings up an important question. Is Linden Labs accountable in the way the SLLA claims they should be? Well, there's a number of things to consider. First, Linden Labs is a company. Let's face it. It's not a government. Users are paying, they are paying customers who voluntarily enter Second Life for entertainment purposes. Some even make a couple of bucks on the side. Now, at the same time, however, users are the cogs that run the machine. In this sense, they are like collaborators or workers who keep the environment running. The line distinguishing customer and collaborator is becoming hazy. That said, there are two critical aspects to consider as virtual worlds mature: personal livelihood and distributed personhood. Linden Labs opened a huge can of worms by allowing an eternal economy to exist in-world. Savvy users are finding ways to make a living by exploiting scarcity in Second Life. Consequently, more and more people are becoming dependent on Second Life for their income. Moreover, it's not unreasonable to suggest that many future business models will come to depend on virtual environments of this sort. They will be places to conduct business. You may not earn your living in Second Life, but perhaps it'll be an important means for interaction. Things like setting up virtual meeting places, conference spaces, those sorts of things. Second, due to rich and realistic in-world experiences, a significant degree of personhood is transmitted into cyberspace. Users tend to become attached to their Second Life personas. Their avatars are their extended self. And again, this is what's referred to as the extended self or the distributed self. These considerations suggest that tangible harm and injustice can be done to an individual in the virtual world. The line separating the real from the synthetic is blurring, which necessarily means that civil laws will eventually, and will at some point, have to extend into cyberspace. If it can be determined that customers are being harmed by the company running the virtual environment, and that the activities and ventures within the world transcend the company-customer relationship, then regulation and policing will have to be considered. I completely anticipate the day when virtual worlds become regulated. How this will be accomplished, however, is a mystery to me, particularly considering the fact that a nearly unlimited number of virtual worlds can run independent of one another, each with their own rules and agendas. There will be as many worlds as there are ideas, including anarchist states, communist utopias, religious havens, hedonistic wonderlands, and surreal environments. My initial suspicion is that sanctioned and unsanctioned virtual environments will arise. Sanctioned worlds will be regulated and relatively safe, while users will take their lives and livelihoods into their own hands by venturing into the unsanctioned areas. On a related note, a time will come when people start to demand ubiquitous access to the internet and the right to enter and operate within specific virtual worlds. People will start to insist on safe and fair environments in which they can work and play. Further, they will insist on citizenship rights for integral virtual worlds. It's not impossible to believe that Second Life may be one of these worlds. In the meantime, groups like the SLLA will, perhaps naively, continue to agitate and fight for increased political rights and economic privileges in cyberspace. They will undoubtedly fail in their attempt to alter Linden Labs' business model, but it's the precedent of their work that's important. Human activity is very quickly migrating into cyberspace, and it appears that humanity is taking their baggage with them. Eugenics. It's a word that has come to mean different things to different people. Some consider it a pejorative, while others use it as a powerful tool in political rhetoric. It conjures images of Nazi brutality and 20th century zealots working to sterilize the unfit. Ask anyone for a definition and you're bound to get a multitude of different answers. When you key define eugenics into Google, it spews out no less than 20 unique definitions. When stripped of all its historical and social baggage, however, eugenics can be used to describe two general philosophical tendencies. The first, number one, the notion that human hereditary stock can and should be improved, and two, that such changes should be enforced by the state or other influential social groups such as cults, religions, and corporations. Now, these two concepts are not married to one another. Transhumanists tend to subscribe to the first point, but not the second, leading to the charge that they are liberal eugenicists. China, on the other hand, and I'll talk about that in my next segment, engages in a form of eugenics that draws from both agendas. The state is actively involved in the ongoing biological reengineering of its citizens for ideological ends. More broadly, eugenics is an old Greek term that means well-born. The general idea is that genetic constitutions can be improved, either by selective breeding or through more advanced reproductive technologies like applied genomics. Needless to say, it is a highly controversial concept with no shortage of detractors. But what does it mean to oppose eugenics? When one is anti-eugenics, what does that actually entail? Now, there's an old truism, or maybe that's an old Rush lyric, which states that even when you choose not to decide, you have still made a choice. A similar thing can be said about those who oppose eugenics. By consequence, detractors have unconsciously positioned themselves as being either dysgenicists or neugenicists. Dysgenicists, or dysgenics, is the notion that humans should genetically regress from an evolutionary standpoint and default to harmlessness. Yes, there are people who actually believe this, which I suppose is not nearly as bad as the misanthropic voluntary human extinction movement. Such a standpoint can be interpreted as a kind of oxymoronic Luddite transhumanism, where progress is measured not by the increase or refinement of physical and psychological capacities, but instead by their regression. The ultimate goal would be to see civilizations wither away and have devolved humans return to the jungle. Neugenics, which is the majority bioethical opinion today, and most notably the opinion of bioconservatives, human exceptionalists, and anti-transhumanists, is the conviction that the human genome must not be deliberately altered to any significant degree. The general idea is that Homo sapiens are fine just the way they are, and that enhancement will only lead to greater societal discord and or diminished lives. It's like the case of more being less. The underlying assumption is that God, or nature, has already optimized human beings. Human enhancement would only knock over this fragile house of cards. Nugenics is a new bioethical designation that has only come about through the advent of enhancement technologies, which includes artificial selection, all of the old school eugenicists. Not that this is practiced anymore in the West. This particular issue has migrated from the theoretical to the practical, and now that we have the capacity to enhance, it is only by becoming real, or perceived to be real, that an issue becomes political. And here is where it gets interesting. If the state sides with the eugenicists and bans the use of enhancement technologies, then it is enforcing a particular vision of humanity, albeit a fixed one. In this sense, the eugenicists are similar to the authoritarian eugenicists of the past. In each case, individual procreative freedoms have been trumped by the demands of the state, which, in a democracy, is supposedly the consensus opinion. But any discussion of human reproductive rights must critically examine how the state justifies the abrogation of specific procreative choices. Fewer things are more coercive than state intervention in the reproductive practices of its citizens, especially in consideration of the presumption that parents tend to have the best interests of their children in mind. As already noted, state control of human reproduction is one of the two central tenets in the conventional definition of eugenics. The rationale behind the state's intervention in this context is irrelevant, whether it be democratic consensus or totalitarian ideology. As the state exerts a greater interventionist role in limiting reproductive options, the greater is its commitment to eugenics, or in the case of limiting or denying germinal choice technologies, a commitment to autocratic eugenics, or put another way, human genome stasism. One could go even further by suggesting that it is quasi-dysgenic if detrimental traits, such as genetic disorders, are permitted to disseminate and propagate unhindered in the human gene pool. But this is arguable, I will admit, because natural selection already works to prevent this. And this is why eugenics has often suffered the charge that it is pseudoscientific. The parental desire for the so-called designer baby is a reasonable one. It represents the next revolutionary step in human procreation and another victory over the blind forces of nature. Prospective parents will no longer have to rely on the genetic roll of the dice when it comes to determining the health and makeup of their offspring. This said, I'm not so bio-libertarian or naive to suggest that we advocate a genetic free-for-all. Enhancement technologies are monumentally powerful and have the potential to cause great social disruption. Make no mistake, state regulation and monitoring will be paramount. But what's needed is a smart, non-reactive, and progressive hand. This issue speaks to the heart of reproductive rights as it is an empowering technology that will allow for greater individual control and autonomy over personal reproductive processes. But like any new technology, it will be subject to abuse and error. And like any other powerful technology, it will need to be regulated and monitored. Child abuse laws are already in effect, for example, and they will need to be applied to those cases in which the guidelines for how parents can or cannot genetically alter their offspring are disregarded or abused. Finally, another problem with the eugenic vision is its non-interventionist position. Ethics and compassion are not passive activities. It is through our actions that we are able to help. And what is it exactly that we are trying to accomplish vis-a-vis enhancement? It is the fostering of lives that can flourish, self-actualize, and meet their greatest potentials, while ensuring that they are free from as much suffering and undue constraints as is possible. This is a broad vision for the future. There are no predetermined and fixed visions of what humanity must become. Rather, it will be through our collective, compassionate, and common sense actions that we will unintentionally allow the human species to continue to evolve in a positive direction. China's embrace of state-driven eugenics should be of concern to bioconservatives and bioliberals alike. China took a great leap forward on October 15th, 2003, becoming only the third nation in history to put a man in space. On top of a Long March rocket, China's first manned spacecraft, Zhenshu 5, soared into the heavens along with taikonaut Yang Liwei and a profound sense of inevitability. While the feat lagged the U.S. and the former USSR by 40 years, anyone who doubted the inexorable nature of technological progress, even among the developing nations, had their doubts put to rest. The Chinese success story revealed that, given enough time and patience, high-tech makes its way even to the most unlikeliest of places, including former third-world countries. While once the exclusive domain of the Cold War superpowers, space is now accessible by such countries as India, Japan, and various nations of the European community. However, one unfortunate reality of the great catch-up game being played by the former have-not countries is that for many of them, social modernization has not caught up with technological modernization. Yes, it's a positive sign that China is catching up technologically, but the communist country currently resembles an infant who has stumbled upon his father's toolbox. Nowhere is this more so than with biotechnology. The authoritarian Chinese government is using advances in the health sciences to further entrench and realize its eugenic agenda. Beyond the one-child, one-family policy, Chinese eugenics is startlingly reminiscent of 20th century social experiments, including the forced sterilization of citizens deemed unsuitable for procreation, conducted not just by the Nazis but by many nations. This is exactly the kind of Brave New World scenario that keeps bioconservatives up at night, but it's also the kind of state-driven eugenic imposition that even the techno-utopian and bio-libertarian transhumanists worry about. The vision of a centralized, ideological, and hyper-bureaucratized Politburo hammering out design schematics for its future citizens is abhorrent, representing everything to which ideals of democracy and self-actualization are opposed. Consequently, liberal democracies should continue to pressure China to embark upon a path of increasing democratization in hopes that its citizens will eventually demand procreative, cognitive, and morphological freedoms. At the very least, the Chinese example should act as a continual reminder of where we do not wish to go. Historically, the Chinese have operated with the understanding that citizens are obligated with personal duties to the state. And it is partly due to this tendency that Western ideas of individual autonomy are lost. The Confucian tradition, along with its early agnostic and humanist character, placed emphasis on the orderly arrangement of society and stressed appropriate personal relationships. In conjunction with ancient customs and medicine, Chinese tradition holds that every aspect of an expectant mother's life must be controlled. It was commonly held that maintaining a balance in cosmic forces, in essential bodily fluids, and in lifestyle both before and after conception was paramount if you hope to have a healthy baby. The Chinese also subscribe to the patrilineal model of descent, in which a person is viewed as the culmination of his or her ancestors and is held responsible for the health of all future generations. Thus, an expectant mother's behavior and attitude is believed to directly influence the well-being of her future baby. And a deformed or developmentally disabled child reflects a moral failing on the part of the parents. As historian Frank Dukater has noted, herein lies the basic eugenic belief that human intervention in the form of behavior and morality can shape heredity. It was not until after World War I that modern science was introduced to China. It was during the Republican era, which went from 1911 to 1948, that elites called for increased intervention of medical professionals and the state into the sexual lives of its citizens. It was also during this time that Western eugenics was imported and combined with existing fears of cultural, racial, and biological degeneration in Chinese society, leading to government regulation of sexual reproduction. Compounding these impulses were the Chinese cultural currents that feared anything deviant and the urge to draw clear boundaries between the normal and the abnormal. Moreover, it is this emphasis on the collective good that has driven modern eugenics in China since the late 19th century, when, as Dukater explains, quote, Chinese intellectuals, the well-to-do gentry, and government officials explored how to improve the Chinese race after the arrival of the stronger Western imperialist nations, end quote. Indeed, as Dukater has aptly observed, nationalism in its many forms remains an important force in eugenics today. And without question, the Confucian ethic, which emphasized the individual's responsibility to the collective, is still felt across China today and has hybridized itself quite effortlessly with Marxist notions of communalism and self-sacrifice. The introduction of communism in China did not do much to change these historical notions or tendencies. In fact, Marxist notions of the blank state and the creation of the new man have inspired Chinese thinkers to mesh Marxist ideals into their already eugenic-primed view of population management. While scientific and technological advancements were stunted during the Maoist era, recent decades have witnessed the revitalization of health-based issues. Deng Xiaoping's reforms of the late 1970s emphasized the rapid development of scientific knowledge and technological innovation, along with acknowledgement that Western-style capitalism was necessary to both increase economic efficiency and state power. While these reforms have led many to conclude that China has finally embarked on the path towards democracy, the truth of the matter is that the totalitarian infrastructure has remained intact. The Chinese political regime has shown no willingness to abandon Marxism anytime soon. This was made painfully apparent by China's ongoing pure humanitarian track record, including 1989's Tiananmen massacre, its suppression of religious and cultural freedoms, its stringent control of information, including its own internal internet, and of course, its devotion to eugenics. As a result of Xiaoping's reforms, the standard of living has steadily improved, as has Chinese proficiency with technology, causing a number of thinkers to push for a renewed commitment for eugenic measures. In 1995, the Law of the People's Republic of China on Maternal and Infant Health Care went into effect. The move was greeted with near-unanimous international uproar. The law primarily seeks to ensure the health of mothers and infants and to improve the quality of the newborn population while reducing the burden of disabilities. Among the many provisions of the legislation was the requirement that all couples seeking to marry submit to a physical examination by a physician to see whether they suffer from any disease that may have an adverse effect on marriage and childbearing. The diseases included genetic diseases of a serious nature that may totally or partially deprive the victim of the ability to live independently, that are highly possible to recur in generations to come. Also covered by the law are infectious diseases such as AIDS, gonorrhea, syphilis, and leprosy, and relevant mental diseases including schizophrenia, manic depressive psychosis, and other mental diseases of a serious nature. Physicians who perform these premarital checkups explain and give medical advice to both the male and the female who have been diagnosed with certain genetic diseases of a serious nature, which are considered to be inappropriate for childbearing from a medical point of view. The couple can marry only if both sides agree to take long-term contraceptive measures or to undergo permanent sterilization. Couples not satisfied with the results of the checkup may apply for an appeal mechanism. When applying for marriage registration, couples shall produce their premarital physical checkup certificates or medical technical appraisement certificates. Diagnosis will be verified prenatally. If an abnormality is detected or suspected, such as by ultrasound or because of family history, after an antenatal examination, if a serious disease or defect is found, physicians will offer the couple medical advice for a termination of pregnancy. Applications to terminate a pregnancy or to undergo sterilization must be agreed to and signed by the person concerned. Couples that are identified by this process shall take measures in accordance with the physician's medical advice. In other words, they will be compelled to do what their doctor tells them to do. Even though this law came into effect in 1995, it's estimated that hundreds of thousands of Chinese citizens have been sterilized against their will since 1986. That's hundreds of thousands. And that's in the last 20 years. Clinic-based and mobile birth control teams, dubiously known as the womb police, have been known to travel across the countryside, enforcing both the number of births and the quality of the newborn population, assessing such things as feeble-mindedness and mental illness. There is little doubt that the maternal and infant health care law is a throwback to 20th century style eugenics. During the first half of the previous century, it was fashionable for the politicians of many countries to implement sterilization schemes that targeted questionable deficiencies while greatly diminishing the reproductive freedoms of their citizens. Two primary factors that led to these policies, two factors that still exist in the Chinese worldview today, are nationally and racially fed conceptions of social Darwinism and an immature understanding of medicine, genetics, and science, not to mention unenlightened and socially primitive stances on democracy and the moral and practical efficacy of individual autonomy. Needless to say, a great deficiency as well in the understanding of the rights of the differently abled and the handicapped community. And I can't even begin to talk about differences in what's referred to as neurotypicality and different and neurodiversity. And typically, the law went into effect in China without any real discussion by bioethicists proper. In fact, it's arguable as to whether China even has a bioethics discipline by Western standards. China doesn't even have the same conception of eugenics. In Mandarin, yusheng is the closest word that corresponds to eugenics and simply means healthy birth. This is interesting because eugenics is a Greek term meaning good origin. But has gone on to mean a centralized, preconceived, and imposed vision of heredity. Moreover, legislators in China don't have to face the political hurdles, scrutiny, and heated discourse that tends to greet new bio-legislation in other countries. Simply put, the communist Chinese government is not held to the same ethical standards as our governments in the more developed and socially mature nations of the world. Of course, in my condemnation of Chinese eugenics, I could be accused of both cultural and social relativism. As medical doctor Patrick McLeod has observed, China is struggling with issues of population health beyond our comprehension in the West. For example, the UK has 5% of the population of China, about 20 times the number of medical geneticists and counselors to serve that population. Compounding the problem, China is largely rural, with health insurance programs that do not cover medical genetic assessments. Some estimates place the disabled population of China at more than 50 million. It is from this perspective, says McLeod, that one can understand why social planners might adopt eugenic solutions without any knowledge or understanding of the long-term consequences for the gene pool. And while the work of many health scientists in the West is stunted by debates about whether or not a microscopic clump of embryonic cells is a person or not, China marches on in terms of important medical research and development. Eric Brown, in his provocative but ultimately technophobic article Brave New China, notes, China has made some brave leaps beyond the rest of the scientifically advanced nations in crucial areas of biogenetic research. Chinese researchers, for example, recently created 30 cloned human embryos and allowed them to develop to unprecedented stages. This work could eventually allow people to grow their own organs to replace failing ones. In Tianjin, a stem cell engineering institute is being constructed that will have its labs filled with 500,000 cloned embryonic cells. As Brown observes, in the near future, China may well emerge as a major global dealer in human genetic and genomic expertise. Recognizing the opportunity China has to leap ahead of a comparatively reluctant West in the world biotechnology market, investors from both China and abroad may provide the capital necessary to drive China's genetic revolution to a much larger scale. Thus, over the next few decades, as the Chinese continue to develop innovative biotechnologies and as they continue to impose their eugenic policies, they will have greater and greater control over how they actively re-engineer their citizens. From a democratic transhumanist perspective, these prospects are both exciting and troublesome. Transhumanists agree that stronger, smarter, and healthier people are a good thing, as are reductions in suffering and various psychological and physical disabilities. But while progress in health sciences is a value unto itself, it shouldn't come without proper public debate or the proper bioethical infrastructure to gauge the impact of technologies in individuals, societies, and the human condition as a whole. Worst of all, in China, these technologies are being used as tools by the communist government to impose its idea of a healthy and evolving populace onto its subjects. This idea, that of a totalitarian transhumanism, is anathema to democratic transhumanism, which insists that choices about whether and how to use these biotechnologies must be left to individuals. While some of the goals of transhumanists and Chinese politicians run in parallel, the manner and spirit in which they are applied makes all the difference, both from ethical and socio-political standpoints. It is understood by most transhumanists that parents, when empowered to make the informed, procreative decisions for themselves and their families, will make responsible choices that will result in the improved health of their offspring. How the human family evolves and develops as a result of these individual choices is anyone's guess, but it must be the role of future governments to help their citizens prosper along chosen paths, not to dictate preconceived and groupthink notions of what it means to be normal or healthy, and certainly not to do so from a rigid ideological agenda. I can only hope that as China modernizes itself technologically, social and cultural modernization will quickly follow. The impact of the information revolution has only recently been felt in China and has been greeted with great caution, resulting in the Great Firewall of China. Fortunately, technology often acts as the great equalizer. And as mobile phones, computers, and other information technologies make their way into China, the Chinese will surely start to take advantage of these tools as they begin to democratize themselves at the grassroots level. The push for better science and technology, I can only hope, will be the ultimate undoing of the current communist regime rather than further its state-driven eugenic goals. And that concludes this week's episode of Sentient Developments podcast. Hope you enjoyed the show, and I would very much like to hear your comments. And you can email me, george@betterhumans.com. Look for my next podcast to appear in about a week's time. Let's go over the tracks that played during this week's episode. The first track was from Of Montreal. The track was called The Past is a Grotesque Animal, and that's from their recent album, Hissing Fauna, Are You the Destroyer? I gotta say, so far, 3 months into the year now, that's probably my favorite album, the best album I've heard so far. Again, that's Of Montreal. The second track, Brand New Air, from their album Pocket Symphony. That track is the first track off the album called Space Maker. The third track was from Toronto's very own Broken Social Scene from their wonderful album from a few years back. The track was called Capture the Flag, and the album is called You Forgot It in People. And lastly, post-metal band Cult of Luna and their track Dim. Again, thank you for joining me today on Sentient Developments Radio. I look forward to speaking to you in about a week's time. Until then, bye-bye.